And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Stuart Coop. Stuart is an author, a music commentator, an independent artist, publicist and a radio broadcaster who has been involved with music all his life. The new book we're talking about today is called Roadies, The Secret History of Australian Rock and Roll. Stuart, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Thanks, Bill. Nice to be talking to you.
Stuart, you've been around the music industry for about 40 years, so it's great for me to get to speak to another old rocker about about a book. You say you didn't want it to finish, so it must have been fun to research and write it.
It was an absolute thrill. I interviewed about 50 Australian roadies. I could, of course, have interviewed thousands of roadies. And I went back to what I think is arguably having the first Australian roadie, who sadly passed away a few years ago. But that takes us back to the era of Cold Joy and the very late 1950s. And then I continue right through to some road crew who are working with contemporary artists, and you know, right now. So I was trying to tell, you know, a story about, you know, basically 50 years of road crew and live music in Australia.
And as far as a career path, I went to a John Paul Young show the other night, and he said that two of his roadies were now in the band, one playing bass and one playing rhythm guitar. So can we exclude this? Are you and are the roadies just frustrated musos?
I think some of them, from my experience researching the book, I'd heard that too, Bill, and I thought, oh yeah, they're all people that want to be in bands. A lot of them did start in the early days just playing around, you know, in high school bands, you know, as teenagers. But I didn't find as many quote unquote frustrated musicians as I thought I would. I really found for the most part, people, you know, and I encountered more women, much to my pleasure than I expected. But I encountered people that they clearly love rock and roll and music. They love the lifestyle, but they really are immersed in the technical side of, you know, how it works and how to make it work and how to make it work quickly when something goes wrong during the middle of a show. So, you know, they're around music all the time. So, I think most of them, you know, have some, they need to have some knowledge of, obviously, you know, tuning instruments and playing instruments and things, but not exclusively. But I didn't find as many as I expected who were sort of going, oh, I could do better than so-and-so. Oh, I can't wait until he leaves the band, then I'll join. I did hear some good stories from John Paul Young's roadies over the years, that's for sure.
So what was your main motivation in writing this book, Roadies?
Look, there were two motivations, Bill. The simple first one was to just look at the stereotype of the Australian roadie, which is someone, you know, usually male, not that smart, lots of muscles, who's good at lifting things and pushing things around, takes bad drugs, and is a bit of a reprobate, right? So that's the traditional notion of the roadie, and I found that whilst some elements of that are true, the majority of them are not. So I wanted to do that. I guess there were three things. I also wanted to continue what I've been doing with some of the recent books, which is to record oral history of people who are working in the entertainment business in Australia. You know, people who are, you know, people are passing away at a rapid rate, and a lot of these stories are being lost. And then there was a darker side to it. You know, I was told a couple of years ago that Australian roadies have anecdotally somewhere between 4 and 5 times the national suicide rate. It's a horrible statistic, and there's also a wide range of other mental health issues associated with road crew. So I guess I also wanted to find out why, because on a superficial level, you know, the life of a roadie looks pretty terrific. You know, there's no office job, they're careering around the country or around the world, they're hanging out with rock stars and artists, and, you know, it looks, you know, hard work, of course, but there is a degree of glamour associated to the perception of it. So I was, you know, wanting to know why so many of these people, highly skilled people, very experienced people who'd been road crew for a long time, were taking back in their lives, you know, particularly in their late 40s and early 50s when they finished, you know, working on the road. So I was motivated by all of those things.
Is it reminded me a little bit of when men leave the army and they've had an all-consuming career, they come out and they find there's nothing, and they also don't like telling war stories. And I think there are similarities with these roadies that you've drawn.
Points I agree totally with, and a lot of them do compare their experience with being someone returning from military service and trying to, you know, fit back into what we will call, again with inverted commas, you know, the traditional world. And in the case of a lot of road crew and a lot of our military people, you know, sadly not succeeding all that well. So, yes, and a lot of people have said to me since the book came out, how did you get roadies to talk to you? Roadies only talk to other roadies. My flippant answer is I think I'm an honorary roadie at the moment. But really my approach was to go to some of the real legends of Australian road crew life. Very early on, I contacted Howard Freeman, who I really believe is the godfather of Australian roadies. Not the first, but, you know, he's 70 years of age and he's still working, you know, in the business. And a wonderful, wonderful human being. I also talked to Scrooge Madigan. Yes, he spells it Scrooge as in the Donald Duck comic with a dollar sign for the S. And Scrooge is also approaching 70, still working as well. So I got the confidence of these guys. And, you know, they'd read some of my previous books and they knew how I approached things. You know, I told them I didn't just want to write a book full of sex and drug stories because I said I find them pretty dull and repetitive. I said I want to talk about your lifestyle, your workload, you know, your experiences. And I got their trust early on, Bill, and then it was a bit of a domino effect. When some of the younger crew said, oh, you know, I'm not sure we want to talk to you, and they said, who else has talked to you? And I said, well, you know, Howard and Scrooge and Nicky Campbell and Mick Cox and John Darcy. And once you name that sort of holy trinity of Australian roadies, the general feeling is, oh, okay, if I'll talk to you, then we're going to talk to you too. Or I would say, if you have any doubts about me, just call Howard, call Scrooge, and then, you know, call me back if you want to talk. They all called back.
Yeah, one of the interesting things, yes, is all those nicknames. You know, you refer to Bear and Scrooge and Pineapple, and there are quite a few of them. But you point out that sometimes these people are actually like running away to the circus or running away from some other thing in their life.
I think that's very much a case that it is a modern day version of young kids, because, you know, most roadies start, you know, when they're in, you know, their teen years, they're 16, 17, 18 as a rule, and they do head off to join a modern day version of the circus. And I think, yes, and that world allows them to live an almost Peter Pan type existence, Bill. So psychological issues that are there, you know, in their teenage years and early 20s. But some of us work out during our 20s, some of us work out during our 30s, our 40s, some of us never work out either. They can be submerged for a good few decades. And I think that's part of where the problems come up, is that they're on this constant roller coaster of adrenaline, travel, excitement, work. And then when they stop, a lot of those things that maybe they haven't had the opportunity to deal with or hadn't even realized were there rear their heads in a very, very, you know, unfortunate manner. And a lot of these road crew, you know, just not equipped, or they don't know where to go. You know, I'm so pleased that the Support Act organisation has recently established a 24/7 helpline for musicians and road crew that, you know, are finding themselves not travelling too well and don't know who to talk to. But also the Australian Road Crew Association organisation, you know, one of the tenets of being a member of that is that each week a roadie will call another roadie and just go, you know, how are you doing? You're travelling okay, you know, and they're really important steps to be taken.
Yeah, we'll have details of those organisations on our website. And just when you were talking then about the hazards, another one is it's not good for a normal family life with a wife and kids, is it, this lifestyle?
No, look, it's, you know, again, another problem when with road crew. It's very, very difficult to maintain a stable domestic life. And it was interesting for me to realise that of the roadies I talked to, the ones that were travelling the best were the ones that had held relationships together. You know, there were a couple of characters I spoke to, you know, who have been with the same person for 45 and 47 years. And they were certainly in a different headspace from many of the others. But, you know, an Australian roadie can expect to be away 10 or 11 months of the year. You know, your work is away. Your work is at night. Your work is travelling. And, you know, some of them get themselves, you know, get into mischief whilst they're on the road. Sometimes their partners just think they are and then leave them because they don't believe that they can be away from home and not getting themselves into trouble. So it's not a lifestyle that lends itself towards stable relationships, you know. And there were some very poignant moments, you know, in my conversations with roadies. You know, I think back to John Darcy, who worked with AC/DC in the early years, and Bon Scott asked him if he'd like to go to England with AC/DC. And at the time, his wife, and they're still together, was pregnant with their first child. And John just said, you know, I came from a broken home and I didn't want to be that father and continue that sort of tradition. So, you know, he made a decision to stay and get off the road and be a father and not go to England with AC/DC. You know, and I'm sure he's happy with his decision, but a lot of people didn't make that decision, and a lot of them, you know, suffered ultimately because of that.
And we're speaking today with Stuart Coop, who is the author of Roadies, The Secret History of Australian Rock and Roll. Stuart, we might just take a short break now and go back to 1967 and listen to a great song by the Executives called My Aim Is to Please You.
Kissing and squeezing me.
And that was My Aim Is to Please You by The Executives, a great song from 1967. And we're speaking today with Stuart Coop, who is the author of Roadies, The Secret History of Australian Rock and Roll. So, Stuart, going back to those early days, you describe it as one man, one van, one band. That's the early portrait of a roadie, I guess.
It really was all about the van. You know, if you didn't have a van built, you couldn't be a roadie. You know, you learned everything else as you went along. You know, there were no schools, there was no training. You know, you picked up how to, you know, wire up the very rudimentary PAs and how to tune a guitar and how to put a drum kit together and all that, just as you went along. But you had to have that van. And yes, in those very early days, in the late 1950s and 1960s into the 70s, it really only required one person to move the PA equipment and the band's equipment around. But then things gradually started to get louder and bigger. Most people blame Billy Thorpe and Lobby Lloyd for this. You know, Billy Thorpe wanted to be louder than everybody else. So suddenly the amplifiers got bigger, and you know the rest of the stage gear got bigger, and suddenly they needed two, and then you know eventually three and four road crew to move all the gear. And of course then you know another pivotal moment was when Countdown went to air, and suddenly here was colour television, and audiences around the country were seeing, you know, all the lights and all the colour and excitement of a music show, and they wanted to see that reflected when they went to see shows in pubs and clubs. And so the lighting had to become more complicated and bigger and better, and so that required more people and bigger vans. And of course now we get to a situation where a band like AC/DC or the Rolling Stones these days will travel with more than 50 semi-trailers mm-hmm. of equipment and a couple of hundred people on the road to look after it and maintain it.
We've established one essential is a van. What would you see are the other essentials of being a roadie, and how does it differ from being, say, a stage manager or a tour manager or some one of those other titles?
Well, in those days, you were all of those things. A roadie in the early days did everything. They drove the band, they got them up to go to the gig, they collected the PA, they set it up, they operated it, they collected the money at the end of the night, they booked the hotels or accommodation and whatever that was needed to be done. So, you know, in those days, you know, the roadie needed to be a jack or jill of all trades. And, you know, they needed to know how to tune guitars, they needed to be able to fix a drum kit. They had to be across, you know, every aspect. One roadie said, you know, he did their laundry, you know, for their stage costumes for one particular band. So, you know, and another roadie talked about, you know, how he cooked meals for the band, you know. So they really did everything. And it was only as the road crews got bigger that there started to be more specific and precise roles like tour manager, road manager, you know, stage monitor, lighting person. You know, in the very early days, you know, someone would be mixing the sound and flicking the lights at the same time, because both of them were so simple and rudimentary that it was easy to do that. You know, the lighting shows were pretty much on and off, and then maybe just a couple of colours, and the sound equipment wasn't much more complicated. But they really had to love the lifestyle. Yeah. You know, they had to love the travelling, they had to love the late nights, they had to like hard work. You know, in those early days, Bill, you know, not uncommon for a band to do five shows in a day, starting at a school at lunchtime and working, you know, your way in towards the city. You'd play a mid-afternoon show, you'd play an after-school show, you'd play an early evening show, you'd play a midnight show or an 11 o'clock show, and then you'd finish up in the city somewhere, you know, at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. Not uncommon in the slightest. So you had to love it. You know, that was the first and foremost, you know, tenet of being a roadie.
You also make it pretty clear in the book that they have a role as, I suppose you'd call it, a procurement officer. They're the ones who get the drugs, the grog, the women, the whatever else goes with the lifestyle. But now I guess things have changed with occupational health and safety rules.
Yes, things have changed. Yeah, roadies always used to brag that they had the best drugs. I'm not sure whether that was always the case, but that's what they'd like to think. But, yeah, look, that world has definitely changed, you know. I mean, a lot of these roadies were operating in the world before we even had, you know, RBT. And, you know, I was staggered during the course of my research. Sadly, yes, we've had some horrible road accidents involving roadies. But given the millions and millions of miles and then kilometres that they travelled, I'm staggered that we can actually list, you know, the really major incidents on two hands. You know, I think of, you know, Sherbet losing some crew, a very tragic accident, you know, involving Max Merritt and the Meteors. You know, Cold Chisel lost some crew members when they were working with Swanee. More recently, Thirsty Merc lost some crew guys, you know. But the fact that we can list them all fairly easily surprises me, because there should have been more. But, of course, I'm glad there weren't. But, you know, driving whilst you know, drinking and under the influence of drugs, setting up and operating equipment in a similar condition, you know, it really just doesn't happen anymore. And I think that's a very good thing. You know, there is, you know, particularly these days with the size of the shows, you know, there's an enormous amount of responsibility in setting up, maintaining and operating that equipment. And when I walk into a big concert and I'm underneath, you know, 25 speakers hanging seemingly precariously from a ceiling, you know, or a roof above me, you know, I'm kind of pretty excited to know that the person or people that put them up there were not out of it on drugs or alcohol and are very skilled and had, you know, worked out exactly how much weight can be lowered from that ceiling and all of those things. So, no, the occupational health and safety aspect of live music in general is one that has to be welcomed by anyone.
Another great thing in your book is that you get this unique insight into the artists themselves that you get from the roadies, and I'm particularly intrigued with some of the what they call riders, with the bands have requirements for when they're not on stage, and the roadies have to just have to do it, don't they?
Yes, I mean, you know, the backstage requirements of many musicians would make most people roll their eyes, going, if you know, if, how can you function with that much alcohol in your system or that many drugs or anything? You know, and look, a lot of them ask for things just because they can, and you know, but yes, road crew have to look after all of that stuff. You know, I do say that, you know, roadies are the custodians of all secrets, all the great secrets and all the bad secrets. And I think, you know, it's a musician or artist who crosses their road crew at their peril, you know, because, you know, these road crew have seen, or, you know, every Australian musician they've worked with or for at their absolute best, but they've seen them at their worst too. Jimmy Barnes is not alone in saying, you know, and he's quoted in the book, you know, saying, you know, he's lost count of the number of times that, you know, his road crew propped him up, got him on stage when he was in no condition to be performing, and they made sure he did the best possible show he could under the circumstances. And they, you know, they sourced and made available for him whatever was necessary for him to get through many, many, many shows.
Yeah, there are some fantastic stories, lots more than we've talked about even today in Roadies, The Secret History of Australian Rock and Roll by Stuart Coop. Stuart, we've reached the stage of the show where we ask our guests to pick a song. Would you like to pick any from your vast catalogue?
Oh, look, I could have picked hundreds, Bill, but I'm opting for Eagle Rock by Daddy Cool for a couple of reasons. The most recent reason is, you know, we've held some lunches around the country to raise money for Support Act and their work with roadies, and at the one in Melbourne recently, Ross Wilson got up and closed this lunch, you know, in front of 250 mainly roadies, and he sang Eagle Rock, and I was reminded of just what an amazing song, and a timeless song that still sends chills up my spine, you know, and I've heard it thousands of times. And also because I chose it because it seemed to epitomise, you know, a time and place in Australian music. Their roadie, you know, and their roadie for their entire career, Scrooge Madigan, gave me so much time for this book. But, you know, we talked about Eagle Rock, and Scrooge said to me one day, he said, "You know what Eagle Rock meant to me, Stuart?" And I said, "Scrooge, I've got no idea." And he said, "Look, I know it was a number one, but all it meant to me was 14 gigs a week. Suddenly we had to work even harder." And he said, whenever I think of Eagle Rock, he said, "I just think of how many shows we had to do week after week after week." So, you know, for those reasons, that's my choice.
And that was Eagle Rock by Daddy Cool from 1971. Don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email and we'll be in touch. And if you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. So it just remains for me now to give a special thank you to Stuart Coop. Thank you very much for being on Dads on the Air.
Thanks for having me on the air, Bill. Been fun talking to you, okay?
And we'll be back next week with another show on Dads on the Air.